Richard Wentworth, we're in the Listen Gallery, standing beneath a piece you've installed here called False Ceiling, which comprises hundreds of books suspended from the ceiling just above head height in the section of the gallery we're standing. There are many ideas that come to mind in relation to the analogy of so many books representing so much information, so much knowledge above one's head. But perhaps you could start by talking about the issues and concerns of this particular piece.
First of all, about 2 years ago, I used a dictionary. And in the dictionary, I put sweet papers that couldn't in any sense be said to be a description of the form or the content of the sweet that they supposedly describe. So these sweet papers would project from the dictionary, and the dictionary had a kind of bulimic feeling as a result. There's a piece called Tract, From Boost to Wham. And I then went to work in Berlin for 15 months. And I think one of the strongest feelings about being there was actually the first time I'd really felt cultures in collision. I mean, it's something that's talked about a lot, and we know that, you know, the 747 has ruined the world that existed 20 years ago or changed the world or whatever, but the actual palpable feeling of the East in collision with the West and a kind of fallout. I spent a lot of time in markets, one in particular in a street called Gustav Meyer Allee in Wedding, which is a kind of, I suppose, a sort of Finsbury Park of Berlin, where you would find Russian army fatigues mixed up with American army fatigues in great big bales, you know, the stuff of the end of wars. And amongst all of this would be boxes and boxes of china and books. And the books would be socialist manuals, Russian books, out-of-date technical West German books, all the stuff that's kind of reigned through the society and has eventually lost its meaning, or apparently lost its meaning, but waiting for others like myself to revalue them. And of course that's would be familiar to anyone that goes to a market. You always see these boxes of kind of really lost knowledge, or knowledge which is getting lost. Perhaps the central irony of that is a mixture of things, because you simultaneously know that those books belonged to somebody, so they're actually somebody's possessions. They may even reveal that, because they may say something inside. They may even be from somebody to somebody, so there's a kind of, there can be a tenderness in there, or somebody addressing somebody else. There's the sense of somebody having labored to make this thing. There's the whole sense of publishing, and a feeling of it all draining, you know, that it actually has fallen, and this is its last chance to be reclaimed. You know, there's a kind of recuperative possibility. But if you go to the market, if you go to Brick Lane in London at the end of the day, half the books will be in the gutter, they'll be wet, and they're, you know, they're literally dying. So a year ago, if you'd talked to me, I would never have occurred to me that I could turn that into any form of work. But I think being repetitively subjected to that, you know, twice a month I would see it. And eventually something about the collision of what you might say was the abstractness of a book, the fact that a book is only has as much meaning as you can find meaning in it. If you don't read it, it's got a limited meaning. Hybridized with its physicality, you know, that books have color, thickness, weight. You more or less know from looking at them whether you could enter them or not. Sometimes they're kind of arcane, you know, they're some branch of science that you'll never imagine yourself entering. So when the opportunity came to make this show, which was actually quite recent, it wasn't something that was particularly planned, it seemed a moment to, you know, fly by the seat of one's pants and see if I could actually pull all these sentiments together into a single piece of work. It's probably true to say that there's an element of something verging on spitefulness, because I think there are architectural propositions in the gallery which are actually unsustainable. Another part of a kind of English crisis of arriving at modernism very late. A whole predicament of received opinion. And I've never felt very happy with this space. I mean, it's a space that a lot of people think is rather marvellous because it's the kind of icon of the late 20th century gallery space. You know, people come from abroad and say, oh, it's wonderful and what have you. But of course, on the Quart, we all know that it's a conversion. You know, we know it's the absolute typical English predicament of the 19th century struggling to be the 20th century. And in fact, as we speak, we've passed that century altogether. We're going to go into another one. So I wanted to do something that was a little bit like the inverse of the fitted carpet. I wanted to do something that would kind of haul this space together, but in an utterly provisional and slightly irresponsible way. You know, the books propose that they have a centre of gravity, and I suppose out of that is maybe a sort of oblique reference to gravitas. But as hard as you might try to find the centre of gravity, just the physical fact of trying to find the middle of the book, you know, I don't think there's one here that will sit straight. But of course, you know, my work usually involves an element of failure. You know, you can see that I would make an argument with the proposal of a perfect world and simultaneously try and offer an admission, that one's going to that perfection, that ideal, is really vulnerable. So even the act of just trying to hang them up, you know, the books won't correspond, they won't do it. But that in turn gives you something else, because then they feel almost live. You know, there is a sort of sensuality in here which is incredibly powerful. I mean, much more powerful than I could ever have anticipated, which is contradictory and even quite humorous. You know, there's a feeling. In fact, probably the thing I'm most pleased about is the sense that, you know, it's now very popular in computer graphics to propose a view of landscape, which is the kind of cruise missile view of landscape, where you move very quickly across a surface. I mean, in its primitive form, it appeared in Star Wars. And in fact, it's an experience you never have. I mean, even doing a lot of flying, you don't actually have that experience. It's something about the space that's proposed that's not true. What I like about this is that they are dumb books. They happen to be hung up, which is in a way that's perhaps less than usual. But the experience of walking under it is somehow a kind of truth in precisely the way that this computer graphic model never is. And as you walk through here, partly I think because you have to tip your head back, and I even wonder if that doesn't affect us neurologically. You know, I think you think differently when you look up. There's something quite different about that space above one's self. Maybe because it's a space of reverie, and you know, you immediately feel how rooted you are. And you know, we're stuck with gravity, and this is, in a way, anti-gravity. So there's always this feeling that you're in a kind of inverse landscape. But that, of course, is only true for when you're underneath it, because, as it happens, there's the possibility within this space of getting up above it.
I mean, physically, if we could just draw that out a bit, it comprises of units that are completely separate and disparate, and each book is different from the next one. But you get a very powerful sense of a regular plane or sky or ceiling that's, as you said, just above the head. But you mentioned words such as humour, gravity and irreverence, and these are terms that have often been applied to your work, using ordinary everyday objects taken out of their context and just shifted physically or relocated within a space in an unexpected way. And this work seems to have that sort of edginess, that tension. But shall we walk up to where the books move from being a ceiling to where one looks down on that ceiling.
Yeah. Well, it's more like I'm not somebody who's very good at swimming underwater, but the sensation is a little bit like, you know, if you were fallen overboard and you've got to come up through a lot of flotsam. So by the time you get up, I mean, it's different for different people, but it's, where is it? Sternum. Is it the sternum? It's the lower chest, anyway.
And then
you actually have to breast them. I mean, you actually have to kind of, you know, they knock you.
It did remind me, walking into this particular part of the gallery, which in fact was the entrance the other evening, that it was rather like swimming and moving debris to either side of one in water that had that floating on it. But here we are with the books actually below head height. I mean, here there's another kind of metaphor at work, and was the idea of plotting one's way through a whole kind of scathe of or tranche of possibilities in relation to knowledge and in relation to what the book contained. And one can't help but settle on some of the titles. They go right through the entire range that one would expect them to in a sort of second-hand bookshop or a market stall.
They, of course, always contained, on the whole, quite pleasant surprises. So that was like where you accept that you're making a jump into the arbitrary, but you sort of know that the arbitrary will repay you if you can just go along with it enough. And then the other method was to specifically go to shops and actually select titles, and in a way, rather like a more refined end of cooking, you know, where you'd try and balance the ingredients in a certain way. Now, in terms of being a spectator, it's simply not possible to re-enter that, because you can only re-enter it notionally, because there is so much to look at that it is actually beyond comprehension. And absolutely specifically, you cannot control, I don't want to control, what it is that anyone sees and what order they see it in. So that, I think, as a model, is much more like what it is to arrive in a city and how you arbitrarily try and comprehend the city, and over a period of time you develop patterns within it, you know, eventually end up living somewhere, this has an effect on your perception of the rest of the city, you have favourite areas, or you have areas that you still know nothing about but you have a feeling you don't want to find out about. So there's a kind of an enormous potential here which is up for grabs, and I suppose perhaps I have seen people in here, you know, give it a lot of time. Almost, you know, they're the sort of librarian monkey visitors. You know, they're the people who are trying to collate it, and that's one way of there are guidebooks which will do that to you for the city. Then there are other people whose view of the world is altogether more serendipitous, where they would accept that it's all out of control anyway, and you're not going to conquer the town in a couple of days, you know, with your rough guide under the arm. Much better to just see what it offers you and turn left when the instinct tells you to turn left, and turn right when you feel like turning right, and see how this develops. I have to admit that I'm more of the second persuasion.
I can see factors that this work shares with other works you've made. Whether that's important or not, I don't know, but there is one distinct difference in the knowledge of your work that I have, which is that you've actually used the space, the entire space, in a very particular way, and the entire space, in a sense, has become articulated through the work, through one major work. Is it something that interested you, the idea of using an entire space, a site, really, for a work?
Well, I think the whole question of how I do and don't use space is a source of great anxiety to me, because a large part of my work uses space in what I would describe as a kind of imploded way. You know, there's an object. The object doesn't change its size. And I, if you like, represent it to you, and I say, you know, it's a bucket, or it's a book, or it's a cup. And because it hasn't changed its size, the only thing that I am really able to do is to do something, essentially, to do with the density of that object. And I have, on occasion, felt, you know, that they enormously occupy space, but in that sort of magnetic sense, as if all the available area around them is somehow sucked into them. If that's how you work, then there's always this predicament of scale, and you see it in a lot of artists. You see that the only way out of the scale problem is to go for the multiple. And in fact, of course, there's a history in retailing of this. You see this in, you know, the Stackham High view of the world. So I think that the procedure, funnily enough, the procedure I've used here, which combines everything, is actually very similar to pieces I made where sometimes disparate objects were joined together, you know, two buckets or two metal shapes would actually get joined, who'd never expected to be joined and were rather absurd in their conjunction. But by giving them a kind of internal level, I would sort of insist that they were as one. And in a way, what I've done is to put a rather variable level into the space which holds everything together. I have to admit that in amongst this is a kind of loathing of categories that we all labour under. You know, I implored the gallery never to describe this as an installation. I know that it is an installation, but it's like, that always seems to me like a term which then anaesthetizes the work. You know, it's as silly as saying it's a bronze. I mean, a lot of sculpture is made of bronze, and some of it's good and some of it's bad, but it's not very necessarily very helpful to put this typology in front of the work. And it's nice that you introduced it as a piece which is installed, which is somehow different.
There's something that you either wrote or said a while ago, and I quote, "I live in a ready-made landscape and I want to put it to work," and that seems to me very relevant sentence to recall at this point. I mean, do you think it's as relevant now as it was when you wrote it?
I think that this sense of a ready-made landscape, which I think for most people at the end of the 20th century, if they're not aware of it, you know, they have to be pretty dumb, because we're no longer in a position to even believe in terms like nature. I mean, it's not an accident that the card for this show has a sign in quite evidently manufactured bit of real estate. I mean, there are trees growing, but you can see they were planted, and it says, "Natural area, please stay out." You know, the thing is completely a sort of gigantic oxymoron. And I think that I could get terribly upset about that. I could say, well, you know, it's an intolerable way for us all to live, you know, where, you know, the pastoral is destroyed and we all live in these cities and what have you. But in another way, I think that I've come to see it as absolutely full of possibility. And I think, you know, the agency of a city, obviously it's dependent on your being able to have some sense of control over it, and there are a lot of people who don't have that sense and fall through the social fabric to a point which is very, very disturbing. So I think a lot of my procedures are to do with being troubled about finding a fixed point. There's a way in which, you know, it is important to me that okay, there is a hole through the middle of each book, and it was very difficult to do it. I mean, I didn't enjoy, it doesn't feel right to do that. But in another sense, the hole through the middle of the book is actually no different from the hole that you might have if you wore an earring. You know, it's not a sort of finite damage to the ear. And in fact, all these books are still readable. I mean, the pictures are slightly hurt if they happen to be a picture book. So I think that there is a sense, almost a moral sense, that I like things to be still connected to their origins, still have that directness, and still have that bluntness about them, which essentially is to do with recognition, to do with the fact that that's how we know things. Then you can, you know, from that position, you may be able to go off in other directions, but you need that as a kind of first line of experience.
I mean, one thing that's come to mind is the way in which they give me a sense of butterflies in a case. They've been pinned. Yes. They've been fixed in time. The butterfly's there, but they've sort of been skewered.
Yes.
So their function is both expressed and denied.
Yeah, I think that's very good. I mean, there is a slightly taxidermic feeling of being stopped in some way. But also there's that thing that you know, which is to do with all attempts, all colonial attempts to kind of capture experience, you know, the probably this kind of the great cliche for the end of the 20th century that may yet become a kind of standard for how we behave is the holiday photographs taken to sometimes even taken to the printer while you're still on holiday. You know, people who print, who want to see that they were on the beach the day before yesterday, or at the very least doing it the day they come back, and knowing always that this is inadequate. You know, that's not what it was like. It's Paul Simon singing Kodachrome. So I think that there is something about the fact that in order to offer the books, you simultaneously, you kind of kill them, but you offer them in, I mean, I have never seen books like this before. So although they may superficially stand for, you know, if there was an accident on the motorway and a lorry carrying secondhand books spewed them all over, it's the kind of thing I have taken pictures of in the past, there's a correspondence there. But because you know that this was done deliberately, it's full of intention, and you can't come in here and doubt that intention. You can't doubt 1,500 holes in the ceiling, each with its own hook, and a cable that's the right length, and all of this adds up to a kind of enormity of purpose. But all of that is kind of somehow pulling against the meaning that you want from them. So, I mean, your analogy of, you know, I, of course, prefer the butterfly in the world.
One could argue that there is work of modernism that becomes classical in its own time, and there is work, and I think you make reference to Klaus Oldenburg, and of course there's Beuys and Duchamp, where that sense of classicism and order is subverted and challenged.
I mean, there is a way in which there are connections to Oldenburg, or put better, there are connections to Oldenburg in the sense of things that he's written, and really to early Oldenburg, which I think has a kind of extraordinary pathos. I mean, there's a kind of a pathetic sexuality in the early work, which I think is quite like what it feels like to be a man. I mean, I just think it's a sort of comedy to be one, you know, and you don't have any choice. As it happens, there's a very good Loudon Wainwright song along the same lines. Beuys, I've actually always found Beuys rather overbearing in a way. And I couldn't say that he's somebody I know a lot about or have any very deep sense of affection for. I mean, there's respect there, but that's different. And I think Duchamp is like, you know, accepting your grandparentage. You know, it's like there are people that you just know made an enormous space in which you were then allowed to be 50, 60 years later.
The show here is a kind of retrospective. It goes right back to the early 70s. It shows documentation of works, performances from the early 70s in the first space. As you enter the gallery, there's a sound corridor, which is a very early piece of yours. And then there are some later pieces. Could we start by talking a little bit about the first space, the documentation of the works, a word which you used quite often as a title, as a generic title for those pieces, was rhythm. Could you tell me something about what you thought of that word as meaning?
Before I made performances, I was busy with making the sound environments. And somehow, once Chrissy Eisler actually wrote in a text that through the sound I entered the performance. And it's quite true, because my sound installations, in a way, it was a base for many of my performances. So the first performances I'd done, there was a series of the rhythms, and I was very concerned about the sound elements in the performance. So the rhythm 10, it was the sound of the knives. In rhythm 2, it was the sound, but it was actually the rhythm of my contraction of my body, two different ways. Then rhythm 4, it was actually about the wind, sound of the wind, and the changes, what the wind do on my skin. Then the rhythm 5 was not really in a kind of traditional way sound, but it was relating to the light. Every time I would burn a piece of my hair, of my nails, or whatever I would throw in the fire, I would release this kind of light, and that light was a rhythm for me. And then finally, in a rhythm zero, I actually didn't move in the space. Public will actually do things to me. And so it was like, rhythm was like a kind of first group of my ever early performance works. And later on, I use the sounds, but more in my video kind of compilation work. And when you see this exhibition, it is kind of retrospective, but what I never done actually is to connect everything with everything. And in the beginning, it was not so clear because you have this urge to doing different things. You have the urge to do video installations, objects, the photography, the performances. And sometimes you don't see the right way connection. But in this point of my life, when I look backwards, it's like 25 years of work, I really see there is an incredible link that actually it's all about almost same thing, but in different ways, using different materials. But it's all about really pushing body in the kind of mental and physical limits.
In the first works, that idea of the extreme is very clearly there. You can see it because you are very literally pushing your body to the limits. In a number of instances, you actually become unconscious in the course of the performance when you're in the middle of the fire in Rhythm 5. You actually passed out. There's another performance, Lips of Thomas, where you're cutting yourself and lying on ice and so on. These are very severe, extreme things. What was the passage from the early sound works, the idea of using sound, into the point where you actually felt that it was necessary to use the body itself?
In early days, my sound installations was like I am. Some pieces I realized, some pieces just will stay as a concept because of not getting permission or physically or technically was not possible. So one of the pieces was that I wanted to put the speakers on the bridge, main bridge in Belgrade, with the sound of bridge falling down. And when you're actually walking on the bridge visually, the bridge exists. And by sound, he every 3 minutes is collapsing. And I could not do this because they told me, in a city government, that actually by putting this kind of installation on the bridge, because the vibration bridge may fall. So, you know, it was about extreme, but I could not do it. And in a way, I don't know what really happened, if I can say, what was the real moment. It was more the kind of process. It was not just one event, but kind of the assembly of different elements that I, in one point, had the need to use the body. Because even working with the sound, I had to use the body, making it, you know, doing things. And the point when I took the kind of courage to make the first performance and use the my own body, how you call this, the experience of that, it was so strong, so overwhelming that I could never anymore be in my studio or do the work alone without being exposed to the public. It was just the strongest experience I ever had doing that kind of work than in any other work I could do. Not sound installation, not my paintings, not my, you know, drawings, whatever I was doing before. So I found out that that I'm kind of born performance artist, that's my way to express the things. And there's this direct energy dialogue between me and public. And also this kind of interesting situation when you really create a kind of mental and physical space in which one you enter. And when you enter this mental physical space, you just can do whatever you want. You become almost like, you transform your ordinary self into your super self, and you can push your limits much farther than you do in reality, and you can really use your body symbolically and as a metaphor in a completely different way than just being in a studio and giving object as a final product to the public. And I always felt in these early days that objects was a kind of obstacle between me and the public, that objects have to be removed and I have to just deal directly with the public.
There's a twin aspect to that use of the body, that extreme use of the body. And it comes up in a word that you use more than once in the documentation, in the text that you put alongside the images. That's responsibility. That on the one hand, you
very obviously are taking responsibility for your own body in the ritual. But in doing so, you're also placing the viewer, the members of the audience, in a position where they also have to take very obvious and conscious responsibility for their own actions as watchers or as people who are going to intervene at some point. Was the idea of the audience and the kinds of responsibilities of the audience something that was there for you right from the beginning?
It was, and I was always concerned about the audience, and I was quite amazed when I was working on this show that, you know, I have this big box with full of my projects and drawings and photographs of all documentation, and I brought back from Yugoslavia 25 years ago when I moved actually to Europe, and this box I really didn't open till just recently, and I was looking through the things together with Chrissy, and it was this amazing things how actually everything is linked to everything else, how I found that I had instructions for the public. Very early, I found the one text of the project I could not realize from, I think it was a 66. I mean, it was a really early project. When I offered the public, offered the gallery, the project, when I want that the public come to the gallery, take the clothes off, and I wash them from them, and then in the process, and they can wash themselves in the process of washing, in cleaning and ironing, on the end they can, you know, get these clothes and leave. Kind of transform, change, you know, clean. And then one of my last book I called Cleaning the House, and I was so concerned always about the body, you know, this kind of inside, outside the body, transformation of the body, cleaning the house, is this cleaning the body, you know, the speaking. And so the audience I give audience an extremely important role, because I never do performance for myself. I always do for them. And I always think that one of the main functions of artists is the function of a servant, that have to kind of, you know, give audience possibility to give them, you know, whatever, the clue or ideas to move further. And I was always interested in the kind of types of artists who actually could change the way of society think. And then, you know, like Duchamp was one, or Rothko, or whatever, the Malevich, you know, the Klein, the people who really can shift different to open different horizons, you know, in the way of thinking. And then you have thousands of them who follow and make, you know, this work more or less the same work, but just that kind of things. And Duchamp said something very important. Duchamp said it's very important that audience is as creative as the artist. You have to work both ways. And I always find way that how to get to the audience. Like now, these objects I'm making, I am really making them for the audience to experience them. And to me, it's not anymore this situation of voyeurism that public come and in a museum, you have not to touch anything, you have to just look. No, they have my work. I call them transitory objects. I never call them sculptures, but they are there actually, in order that the public have to use them. And without using them, they don't have any meaning and they don't have absolutely any function. So only in kind of interaction with the public they can live.
That seems to be a significant difference between, for example, the performance that you did in a number of different ways, in a number of different situations in the early 80s, Night Sea Crossing, sitting without talking, without eating, for a day at a time. And that was very public. People came and saw you do that. And here, the objects for human use that you've got upstairs, these transitory objects, you've put into rooms with doors so that an individual member of the public can go in, close the door, and then lie on them, sit on them, stand looking at them on their own, and get that relationship on their own, and it's not something that is witnessed by anybody else.
Now, since walking the Chinese Wall, I start building transitory objects, and I mostly will put them in a kind of open public situation, and just by observing how public work with them, I find out that they always prefer when there's nobody there to use them, and they're very uneasy to be observed by experience them, because it's very new for them, you know. There are some objects in early stage when public have to make this fundamental step to actually stand on the wall and be part of the object. And this is, you know, big step for the public, who since centuries never done this. So in a way, I kind of think that this giving her a certain privacy and certain different frame, you know, that could work much better. And it's the first time I ever actually decide to make, I call them three cells, and this is called mineral room. We split in three pieces. So is actually dealing with three basic position of human body: sitting, lying, and standing. So you start with a chair completely alone with a crystal on the back in a room facing the wall. The very important instruction is enter the space, close the door behind you, and then be with the object, interact as long as you want, and then leave the room. So you sit on the chair, the next object, lie on the bed, the third one, look in the mirror, and so that these three actions. And in the meantime, while you're waiting to go into the room, if somebody's occupied, you can actually face the wall, press your body against the different pillows made from different materials, like snowflakes, obsidian, clear quartz, green quartz, hematite, sodalite, and just wait and, facing the wall, kind of, you know, experience the energy of that material.
There's a very different kind of an extreme working there. As I say, in the early works, it was very obvious, it's very visible. Mm. In order to, as it were, leave the body to find somewhere else that you can then come back from into your body.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of shouting until you lose your voice, or of speaking until you run out of words to say, or of moving until you fall down exhausted or whatever, that's a very clear, palpable, visible sign. But this is also, it seems to me, about an extreme, about a way of finding some route out of your body to somewhere else again from which you can come back to. And one needs that kind of quiet space.
It's interesting. I had this old professor in Yugoslavia who I went as a postgraduate student to study in Zagreb. And he told me the most important things in my life I always kind of remember. The first thing he said, you know, in your life, you think that you have many ideas, but it's absolutely not true. If you're very lucky as an artist, you may have one good idea. And if you're really extremely lucky, maybe you have two good ideas, but this is all. Be very careful with them. And the second thing he said, if you're drawing very well with the right hand and you get better and better and better and you become virtuose, right away change to the left hand. And I think I've been exercising these two things. When I look at my work, I really think that my all work, even if this changed so many forms and using so many different materials, is just about one simple thing. And it's always about how we could transform our, you know, body physically and mentally. And even this very early corridor deals with this space. The public have to go through this sound corridor. When I made in Yugoslavia 72 in the museum there, when actually you have to kind of be killed, but is aggressive and is light and is extreme. But in the same time, if you come to the museum, you see, you have to be empty in order to receive. And we are never empty. You know, we are coming with maybe shopping bags. We are coming with our diaries. We have to make phone calls. We have to have another meeting. We have to do this. We have to do that. You know, it's always some projection into the future or remembering past. So it's a kind of luggage. Going through this corridor is like a purification, because you actually, the sound empty you.
Was the period of your collaboration with Ulay during the late 70s and the 80s a time in which that single idea of yours, that important strong idea, that thread that runs through the work, was approached in a different way? Or was there something else about the work that you did there that you think might be slightly different?
It's not really much difference, I think, because with only thing what I done there, it's like open myself to really deal with my own ego, because there was, you know, artists have this very strong ego where they really have to deal with, and working with another artist, you have to kind of put your ego on the side, and not only me, but he had to do the same, and we create something we call that self, this like kind of three-dimensional kind of hermaphrodite body, you know, like male, female, united together and produce one piece of work. And it was very strong and very important experience in my life. I mean, it came in the just right time, because I kind of came to the almost limit of my own body, how far I can go. I mean, the next step is dead, and it was not about dying, you know, the whole thing. And so he came as a really answer to how to continue. And I think I also came in his life in the same reason, because he was very much busy with identity and who he is. And he have, when I met Ulay, he have a half of the face completely painted and with makeup, with the long hair as a woman, another half completely unshaved with the beard and very masculine short hair as a man. So he had this half polarity already in him. So when I arrived, he could remove his female part because I replaced it. And in a way, it was just really the perfect unity, and it was very strong emotionally, and was a kind of the biggest love in my life anyway. So this was very, very strong. And this body of work went for 12 years. And the most difficult was when we really could not work anymore together and came this separation completely, that actually even in the last stage of relation, separation we show in our work. Because we made the shows when we show two separate works. We didn't even talk to each other, but we still did it. So the separation was the last part of relation, and that was the hardest. But somehow we went from the beginning till the end, and the culmination was really saying goodbye on Chinese Wall. So that was done. And I think was, you know, this thread of this idea from my work before with Ulay and continue, is it's not really interrupted by working with him.
What kind of power does the idea of the structure of a work have once it starts? For example, you mentioned there that at a certain point the obvious next step would be death. But in this idea of an extreme, it's never the extreme itself that's important. It's only that the extreme functions as a way of getting to where you want to get to. Mm-hmm. Is there ever a sense in which you recognise that this is what you need to do next in a piece, but that actually once you start to do it, it seems impossible to do?
I never get to this point. It's very strange. But, you know, I'm really amazed about myself, but I had my first show at age of 12, and I never first doubt in my entire life that I can be anything else but artist. I can't do anything else. I mean, my life, my work, everything is like connected to this, and is I never actually doubt. And then when I have one idea, and especially if I'm afraid of idea or I'm incredible, have problems with this idea, I get obsessed about it, and I whatever it takes, I will do it. Chinese Wall was one of these impossibility. 8 years took us to get permission. Nobody ever wanted to believe that it finally could be. We made it. Plus, even in our relation, in the beginning was when we start Chinese Wall, it was in perfect harmony, and then waiting of 8 years, this all dissolved. We even, you know, split, but we still had to do it. And I don't know, I have this kind of strange willpower that I think is nothing impossible if you can put your will in it, and whatever it takes. So till now, I can't recall any project I want so much to do and I didn't do it.
Could you say something about the room, the large room upstairs, in which you have the objects for non-human use? There are two beds or platforms very high up, which one can't obviously see on top of because they're much too high. There's a multi-monitor video piece of you scrubbing clean a skeleton. There are a couple of other works in there as well. And this is a public space. This is not somewhere that you go into and close the door. Everybody can look at these things together. And yet you talk about them as being non-human use. I presume that that's something to do with an aspect of spirituality that runs throughout the whole work. But could you say something about that?
There is a kind of gradual steps I build up to that room. Because in the beginning, you really, first you go to sound corridor, you clean yourself. Then you see the photographs where you can see what kind of limits you can face, you know, physical, mental. Then you go to the room with the wounded geode that you have to sit and just, you see, in every installation, the chair is always higher than your feet, so you're always never reaching the ground. So you have to feel kind of smallness and different gravitation. And then you go through these cells when you really confront yourselves and you kind of build up your sensitivity. And then you enter to this big space where it's all objects for non-human use. And it's a really contemplation room. When after all these experiences you went through the other rooms, you come to that thing with this kind of immaterial, non-material world can be visible if you're sensitive enough. So I propose there is the beds for the Aphrodite and her lover, who, you know, she used. there is God punishing work with the whips made from the virgin Korean hair, because there is a tribes in Korea when before marriage the woman cut the hair, it's like power, so I made the whips out of them. And there is this video installation when I actually really clean the skeleton. We have such an incredible fear of dying and such a kind of, you know, the obstacle of thinking about that point. And I think we have to really get into it. So I took this brush, cleaned the floor, and I went into ribs. I cleaned this body like it's my own skeleton. And the public have to feel it's their own skeleton seeing it. And then, you know, when in this cleaning process, you can receive. And then on the end of the actually complete exhibition is this power object. This is a new piece I just made, and it's actually going to completely open a new body of work. I'm now shifting from the minerals. This is a shell of iron. On this shell is a big piece of tourmaline I got from Amazon mines. There is two wax figures who have secret objects inside of them. I will not tell what. They are bandaged together, and they're male and female. One is facing earth and one is facing sky. And they're all sucked in the fresh pig blood by the slaughter pig. And I call the power object, but I also call this place of sacrifice. It's just the kind of power place in the museum where you actually end the show. And there you see you're in a situation that you, the object have a power itself. It's something has happened there. I mean, if you go close to this object, is you have to feel it. Is a, you know, there is no rational explanation. There is no. It's just the presence of something. And I really am interested on the possibility how the object itself can radiate that presence.
In the short space in between those two last main parts of the exhibition, the cells and the final big room, there are some mirrors for departure, which are the impressions in clay of faces. Again, there seems to be this idea of always of going and coming back.
This room is a clay room. It was a very difficult space, but we know the clay is absorb and neutralize energy and clean up. It's a cleaning process. Clay, you know, the mirrors are like halfway between life and death. I ask people to impress the face, and it's not the mirror like normally reflect. It's the mirror you go through. And then on the other side, there are clay pillows who you have to neutralize your energy. Whatever you experience through other rooms, here is energy absorbed. Negative energy is gone. And then you can enter to the non-human use room completely kind of transformed. So this really exhibition, public have to work a lot. It's really for them to work and to spend time in it. And it's not really about looking, it's about experiencing.